Hi, this is David Russell. Welcome to episode 6 of the No Bad Bosses podcast. This is sponsored by Dave's Charm School, which is the only soft skills training for IT service providers. Also could be referred to as EQ training, emotional quotient training. And you can visit managetowin.com/charmschool to learn more. Now, my guest today is Marcus Bigelow, and he is the Northern California chair at Convene and consultant for Leadership One, a great guy. And I could have gone on and talked for 2 or 3 hours with him. I love this guy. He's going to give you some insights on if you have family members in your business or you have partners, some critical components to make that successful. He gets called in a lot when there's problems there. So let's dive in. Here we go. Okay, we are live actually now. This is episode 6. I've got Marcus Bigelow, who is the Northern California Convene Chair and also does some leadership coaching for Leadership One in the Sacramento Roseville area. Is that a good way to describe it, Marcus?
That's perfect.
Okay. Yeah. So I think before we get started, just because I think it'll be interested to the audience, give your background, will you? I don't always ask people to do this kind of a walkthrough, and you don't have to go, you know, granular, but how did you end up where you are today at the spry young age of, you know, you look like you're probably 39 years old, right?
Hey, thanks, man. you can cram a lot into 65 years. So I feel like Ted Baxter. It all began on a 5,000 watt radio station in Fresno. No, I began my role as a church planter, starting churches, and then led an international church planting organization during which I learned to scale organizations from one a year to 25 a year. And after I left, they've now been able to keep it ongoing, and they're doing 50 or 60 a year. So I learned a lot about scalability, a lot about reproducibility in the church planting world. And then I moved about 5 years ago into strategic planning, executive coaching, and 4 years ago began leading a group of Christian CEOs and business owners called Convene. And I have 15, anywhere from 12 to 15, depending on where the year is, of CEOs that I coach on a monthly basis through that. And then about a year and a half ago, Leadership One approached me and said, would you help us? We work in family business succession planning, helping families pass businesses from one generation to the next. And so that's kind of my life in a nutshell.
Hey, well, I really appreciate you making time to be with us. So I think it's interesting because when you talk about scaling and all the work you did with the churches, I mean, you worked with a wide variety of leaders, you know, in the church environment and also, you know, people in the secular environment, I'm sure supporting those efforts, right?
That's correct. We probably hired 250 plus leaders to lead these churches. We worked internationally. So we did some stuff in India. We did some stuff in Ecuador. So you learn that the leaders are leaders no matter where they are, but they may express it a little bit differently.
So I really want to go into the succession planning, the family stuff, the dynamics between partners, family members, succession planning, that whole deal. But I'm kind of curious, leading off with that background, when you think back on like an example of the worst boss you saw and the best boss you saw, do you have any quick stories with that? I should have prepped you with that, but you probably can have some on top of mind.
Sure.
You don't have to mention names, obviously.
Worst boss I ever had was when I was putting myself through college. I worked for an airline that was going bankrupt, and so they wouldn't buy. I was just a hangar mopper. And one day he said, I want you to go mop the hangar with Avgas, which was 100 plus octane gas. And the pilots all came through there smoking. And I said, I'm not going to do it. And he said, well, you're fired. And I said, well, sorry, but I quit first. So that was probably my worst experience with a boss. Maybe my best experience with a boss has been recently working with guys who are tough, who challenge you, but also who believe in you. And they're not afraid to, I'm thinking of Greg Leith, who's the CEO of Convene, who's not afraid to challenge you and push you, but is also there for you and backs you up. Last week, I had one of my CEOs suddenly had a heart attack and died, and suddenly I was thrust into the middle of his company to help the family, to help the employees, to kind of help them break the news to the employees. And Greg was behind me all the way, was constantly calling and supporting. You can go a long way when you got somebody who's there when you need them.
Wow. Yeah. No, that's quite a situation. So talk to me about, or talk to us a little bit about what you run into with entrepreneurs who have partners or have family members, and what are the struggles that you see that these people have either as a leadership or in their partnership piece?
Well, let me start just with that last example of the fellow who passed away last week. One of the challenges that I then gave to all of the rest of the CEOs in our group is don't have secrets. You know, there's all kinds of loose ends that he had to tie up, that he couldn't tie up, that his family is now having to tie up. And it's not so much that he was secretive, but just he had things that nobody knew about that were going on. And so consequently, for the first week, all these things started popping out of the woodwork. So as much as possible, don't have secrets. Document things. That's just an important thing in terms of succession planning, is you've got to have it documented.
It sounds like you're also saying that the communication piece, I mean, you're talking about secrets, but yeah, really, what is your cycle for communication? And I think this has come up with some of the other podcasts, is what is the cycle for communication with your direct reports, with your partners, whatever, and how do you maintain that? What do you see as the best time frame or format for keeping people informed?
That's a good question. Often, that's a nice nebulous answer. But I think that's, you know, first of all, I think part of it is write things down. You know, there's lots of things that are not written down, and consequently, it's he said, she said kind of a thing. My suggestion would be that every leader needs to have if I get hit by a bus folder, that they stick stuff in that they may not want to make public knowledge all the time, but that people, that somebody needs to know if they should suddenly get hit by a bus, and they need to tell somebody that they trust, hey, I have a hit by the bus folder in my left desk drawer. Or, you know, probably at this point it would be on OneDrive in this file on OneDrive kind of a thing. I guess I'm still old school enough to think about desk drawers. it's interesting. I also say Rolodex a lot. But secondly, there needs to be some open communication with people that are important to you. I think, you know, a weekly update, maybe it's a standing meeting, maybe sometimes even a daily 3-minute standing meeting where you say, this is what I'm working on, and then a weekly, a little more in depth, and then maybe a quarterly, where you really go in depth for half a day with your leadership team, might be a worthwhile thing. And then the other side of it is communicate with your family, you know, tell your spouse, tell your children where things are, because they're going to be the ones that have to scratch around for it. So
I know the guys at Gazelles recommend that you do a quarterly 1 or 2 day retreat as your leadership team to refocus. I kind of like to use the analogy of, you know, you're on a sailboat, and so you want to make certain you're still on course. You want to adjust that rudder a little bit to keep yourself on.
Patrick Lencioni's book, Death by Meetings, I think, or you can also find it in his book, The Advantage, has a meeting schedule that I think is really good for companies, that there's a morning check-in where you do, here's two things I'm working on, or here's three things I'm working on, where you're standing up. It's not a strategy meeting, it's just a check-in meeting. A weekly update for the team, the leadership team, a monthly a couple hour strategy meeting, and then a quarterly getaway retreat where you actually do some serious strategic planning and recalibration kind of a thing. I think the analogy of sailing is good. You've got to make little course corrections all day long.
Yeah.
But then you need to also have those bigger checks where you say, okay, so I've been going in a straight line, but what's the current been doing to us? What are the external conditions? Those kind of things.
Yeah. I think what you bring up where it is the person died of a heart attack. We had a guy in our industry a year or two ago who was I think he was 39-year-old leader, and he was just going on a scuba dive. And he didn't come back up. At least not, he didn't come back up alive. And, you know, total shocker. I don't even know what went wrong. I think his heart gave out or something like that. But he was, you know, relatively young at 39. So it was just a shock. And to not have that communication happening where people can kind of just pick it up and run with the baton type of thing, it really left them in the lurch.
And along that line, you need a hit by a bus succession plan, an emergency succession plan kind of a thing that may not be your long-term succession plan. Your long-term succession plan may be that you're going to, you know, if you're in a family business, you may be wanting to pass it on to your sons or daughters. You may be wanting to bring an outside CEO in. But you need something in the short term that says, you know, if I get hit by a bus, if I drop dead of a heart attack, if I go scuba diving and get eaten by a shark, here's what's going to happen so that things go on orderly. That was really important to me to see how, what fear was in place with the employees as soon as that was taking place. They needed somebody to say, I'm in charge, so that they could keep on working. One of the other things, though, as I look at, over the past 6 or 7 months, I've worked with five family businesses that all are trying to raise up their children to go into a family business. And I think one of my big challenges and big aha moments is that family businesses are dysfunctional. And many of us started businesses because we were trying to prove to our dad that we were valuable. Our dad wasn't able to say, I love you, I'm proud of you. In fact, in March 1971, there's a Harvard Business Review article that begins by saying, the majority of entrepreneurs start businesses because they have a problem with their father. And I see that again and again, that having started something, I'm thinking too. But, you know, what happens then is that the entrepreneur starts a business to prove to his father that he's valuable, that he's got worth. But then that business becomes an extension of himself. And so when he wants to pass it on, he can't pass it on without losing his own self-worth. And so consequently, he often sabotages the passing on part of the business. So he'll say, this is my plan, son, you're going to do this. And son number two, you're going to do this. And then all of a sudden, that doesn't happen. And son number one gets sabotaged, and dad says, okay, I'm going to take the reins from son number one and give it to son number two. And then son number two does something, and the dad says, oh, nope, I'm giving it back to number one. And he just keeps everybody in a state of chaos, because he needs to be the hero to ride back in and salvage the company, because his self-worth is tied to the company. And the company succeeding.
So I'm curious, how do people avoid that?
Well, my big thing right now is that fathers need to give their sons and daughters, not just their sons, but their sons and daughters affirmation. I'll just give you, I lived with a father who is probably as affirming as possible. When I first started a church, I grew it from 75 people down to 23 people. And people were telling me that I was a failure and that I was toxic. I should get out of ministry. And one of the things that happened was every Sunday night, about 8:30, my dad would call me and he would say, son, I'm proud of you. I love you. And you're doing a good job. Don't listen to the naysayers. And there were weeks when I would, when that was what I lived for, was getting that phone call from my dad and having that sense of approval. In a Bible sense, it talks about the blessing, people giving the blessing to their sons and their daughters. And my sense is that sons will go through life trying to prove to their dad how good they are until they receive a blessing. So if you're a father, the importance of giving a blessing to your son is just incredible. I had a machinist that I coached back, 20 years ago now, who was probably the best machinist in a 3-county radius. And he worked in a business with his dad. His dad was a miserable SOB. I don't know how to say it any other way. He was just a miserable guy who was never going to tell his son he was proud of him, who was never going to say to his son, good job. The man put himself in the hospital with a heart attack, trying to work hard enough to gain his father's approval. And it just wasn't going to happen. We are desperate for the approval and the blessing of our fathers. So if you grew up with a father, I called it the John Wayne generation, when you could kiss your horse but not your wife, kind of thing. You know, there's a lot of those kind of guys out there, and it's just not within their toolbox to do that. They may love their kids, but and they may be trying to express it by giving them lots of things, but what they really need is some worth, some sense of worth from their parents. I had a family where the family's probably going to inherit $200 million in a family business. And I think they would give it up if their dad would say, I love you, and would say, I'm proud of you. And they said, that's the primary thing that is ripping our family apart. There's three brothers, and the three brothers are sabotaging each other, each trying to gain approval from their father. So it's a complex situation. And, you know, a family business is ripe for dysfunction anyway. Every family has some dysfunction. But then you've got competition, you've got greed, you've got power, you've got all the makings of the perfect storm for a family dysfunction.
Yeah, and I think you're emphasizing more the traditional father-son relationship type of thing. But as you indicated earlier, this also goes over to the daughters.
Oh, and, sure it does.
And yeah. Father's role with the daughter is much more critical than I think it was realized maybe 30 years ago or something like that.
Yeah. You're right. And I happen to have just seen it with sons. But if I go back a couple of months, I was with a family where the daughter said, this is the thing that's the problem, is dad can't say that he's proud of us. So it's not only fathers and sons, it's fathers and daughters. Or if the mother is the entrepreneur, it's mothers and daughters and mothers and sons.
Yeah. Yeah. So. And it's as a matter of fact, I just, at the recommendation of a friend, just ordered a book on raising daughters. It might be by Tony Evans. I'm not sure, but it's, you know, so I can just refresh that now that we have our adopted kids, 3 out of 4 of this sibling group are girls. So I'm going to go through this whole thing again, but it's surprising to me how many people grow up. I just had coffee with a guy this morning who said he grew up and neither his mother nor his father ever said, I love you, or gave him a hug.
Yeah.
Yeah. And then he was one of five brothers, I think it was. And then he got married and had 3 daughters. He was like, whoa, I got to change things. I can't do it this way. And he has 3 wonderful girls, you know, cause he made a change up. But then you flip that over outside of the family perspective, family business perspective. I mean, Marcus, this is the same thing as far as leaders and employees.
Sure. Because a father, somebody who grew up without a father's blessing, can't pass it on to his employees either. He doesn't know how to say, job well done, you know. And, you know, in the theme of no bad bosses, we need a boss who can say, job well done.
Yeah.
You know, I'll kill for somebody who will tell me I did a good job, you know. Well, maybe not literally kill, but, you know, I will work extra hard for a compliment. when I was growing up, just a short little story, it used to drive my mom crazy that she couldn't get us to do gardening in her garden, but we'd go over to the neighbor lady's garden and we'd work our tails off for her because she'd give us milk and cookies and tell us what wonderful kids we were. And mom, it was just a task, you know? And I think I'd like to think that we get old enough to get past that, but I don't really think so. I mean, I'm 65 and I know that if somebody will give me a good, honest, well done attaboy, it still is meaningful to me. And, you know, the stats are that people don't leave bosses for more money. They leave because they can't relate to the boss, or the boss won't give them job satisfaction and that kind of thing. And people leave because of bad bosses, not because of too little money.
Oh yeah. No, I had a client, which we parted ways in the past year because we disagreed. And one of the things was he just felt that, hey, they do good work and that's why they have a job. I mean, that's what's expected to them. And I'm not going to compliment them when they're doing what they're supposed to do. I mean, I'm old school and blah, blah, blah. And he had a situation where somebody filled in for one of his people and did an outstanding job. And, you know, actually I got an email, hey, just want to let you know this guy's doing a great job. But he couldn't walk across the office and tell the guy that he was doing a great job. So the guy never heard from him. He had to hear it from me. It was, and yet, you know, he doesn't understand that that's not effective, you know, as a leader. So
it's so important. And part of that goes to emotional intelligence, you know, that as a boss, you've got to take every possible chance to improve your emotional intelligence. Because part of that is just, we naturally lack emotional intelligence, I think, for the most part. But the good news is that you can increase your emotional intelligence relatively easily if you'll just apply yourself. It's not something we're stuck with. I've seen people raise their emotional intelligence scores 20 points on a 100 point scale in a relatively short period of time just by focusing on it for a little bit. And when that happens, they're much better, much more able to take care of their employees, to compliment their employees, to understand their employees. I know one of your big things is empathy, which is a key component of emotional intelligence. And I, you know, Patrick Lencioni in his latest book, The Ideal Team Player, says that, you know, employees have to be humble, hardworking or hungry, and people smart.
Yeah.
And bosses need to be humble, hungry and people smart. And the humble part for a boss is maybe the most important, because in Lencioni's terms, it's, do you know who the name of the receptionist is? And you know what she cares about? It's being that team player of caring about the people on your team. And if you do that, you're in good shape.
Yeah, you know, the interesting thing is about a year ago or so, I was interviewing a job candidate for a client. And, you know, we do our talent assessments that assess the behaviors and the motivators of people, sometimes the competencies, but most often the balance between what motivates somebody and then what are their behaviors on the job. And then we ask them to highlight the statements that best describe them and then cross off any statement that they disagree with. Well, one of the statements it said in this guy's report was, you know, so-and-so likes to be complimented for his work. And he'd cross that off as not being accurate. I'd never seen that before. So when I'm interviewing him, I noticed that. And I said, I noticed you cross this off. Do you not like getting compliments? And he said, oh, no, actually, I really do like being complimented. I like it a lot. But in my current work environment, the boss comes around once a week and gives us each a compliment, and it's like he's checking off a list. It's totally insincere, and I absolutely hate it.
I think insincerity doesn't work. but neither is I just worked with a company where the owner's motto was no victory laps. So you could have had the best quarter ever, and he'd come in and say, so forget that stuff. What are you going to do next week? And here's three places where you're failing. And that's a that's such a downer for morale. I mean, to have the, you know, to have a quarter where you've exceeded all your targets and somebody says, we're not going to count that, but here's three things you did wrong.
Yeah.
That just makes it a miserable place to work.
Oh, yeah.
And what you, I think what you find is you have to pay a lot more money to keep people around, or you go through and you know, you have a turnover rate of 75-85%.
Yeah.
Annual turnover rate, which just, you know, is incredibly costly to the company.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
No, I mean it's the top performers are not going to stay for that. They're playing for the prize, and or are dealing with, as you indicated, a message that they got somewhere in their lifetime that they're not good enough. And so they're trying to compensate for that. And then that boss is just validating or reinforcing that message of you're not good enough. So why should they stay there? That's not going to work. So how do people avoid this happening? So how do leaders, we're talking about communication, we're talking about reinforcing and complimenting people, encouraging them when they're down. By the way, I've got to ask. So your church grew from 75 to 23. What happened after that?
We eventually grew back up to about 150. and I've always said, I wouldn't hire myself as a church planter. I was in the wrong position. I'm not a pure entrepreneur. I need, you know, we need to understand what we're good at. I'm not good at taking something from zero to 10 feet off the ground. But if you can get the rocket 10 to 100 feet off the ground, I can take it to the moon in that second stage thing without a problem. I've done it over and over again. Now, the other thing is, don't ask me to go on a voyage to Mars and spend, you know, 9 months sitting in the rocket ship doing nothing, because that's going to drive me crazy. But that second stage, I'm a second stage leader. If you think of in terms of a rocket, you know, I'm not very good at the first stage. I'm really good at the second stage, and I'll jump off the plane and commit suicide if I have to go through the third stage and ride forever in the space capsule. So
how does someone who's at that second stage, or even at the first stage and needs to hand it off, what are the key attributes besides, you know, you said documentation, you said communication, what are the key attributes that enables that leader to pass it off effectively to the next leader, so they don't lose a beat? You think of the relay race. I mean, that pass of the baton is so critical. So often that's where the race is won or lost by the best teams, because the margins are so slight as far as the running time. So how do you do that most effectively as a leader?
I like the metaphor of the relay race. And I heard somebody just the other day, and for the life of me, I don't remember who it is, but he said, when you get handed the baton, you don't own it. You're just getting ready to hand it off to the next guy. And I thought that was really insightful in terms of leadership in a company. I take great comfort in the fact that after I left, the company that I left kept going and actually even got better. Sometimes I get a little bit, when I'm insecure, I think, well, why did they do so well after I left? But the fact that it wasn't dependent on me, I think is a very comforting kind of a thing. And I think the things that you do is you build systems and you build people. And when I left, I had five people that were on my leadership team that were all really capable, and I had not hidden anything from them. They all knew what was next. So when the next leader came in, and actually I got let go because the chairman of our board decided he wanted to put his own boy in, and after I'd led this organization from $750,000 a year budget to $8-9 million a year budget, and had become arguably one of the top 10 organizations in the U.S., but it wasn't quite good enough for him. So that's another story. But I was gone over a weekend. I mean, I had no idea that this was going to happen, that I was going to be gone. But I had put in place people who knew what they were, what they were doing. And my first boss ever in a real job was a president of a college who, as part of his training of me, said, the job of a leader is to find people who are better than they are and get them to play nicely in the sandbox together. And so I always look for people better than I was in their particular field. And then I help them play nicely in the sandbox together. And so that was the relational side of things that I think is important, that you've got a team that cooperates and likes one another. And then that you also have systems in place so that it's not personality dependent. In first stage, people often started on the basis of their personality. They're leaders, they're strong, people rally around them. But if you're a second stage leader, I think you need to be building it so it's not dependent on your personality or your leadership, even though, you know, I mean, I think I did a good job of leading this company. It still was not dependent on my leadership. I made it systems oriented, process oriented, scalability oriented, and then I built a team around me that could carry on, and they just carried on without a beat. You know, they didn't miss a beat.
You know, I fully agree. As you know, my first strand and my three strands leadership is systematic power, because that's where I've been weak in the past. So that's where I try to focus, are those systems. I want to go back to what you said. I find that really striking. I've not heard that before about the baton pass, that it's, you don't own it, but your role is to carry it to the next person. It's kind of like the stewardship attitude, where we don't own the business, we're a steward of it. And so it's a different type of ego. It's a different type of perspective. It's a different type of focus. I'm kind of curious whether you have intentionally tried to look for that in the hiring process, or how you might reinforce that or train that as you're working with your team to get that across to them, that, you know, really what we're doing here is we're building it for the next stage, or we're owning it, and our job is to grow it and then pass it along, versus, hey, this is all about maximizing what we're going to do so it looks good on our resume, or you know, maximizes our pocketbook type of thing.
I haven't, but now that you asked me that question, I think I need to. what I would say is that I think succession plans are always torpedoed by somebody who can't let go. And you've got to train yourself to let go. I'm just convinced of that you have to have that mindset up front that, okay, I'm here for whatever years. And I see it all the time of, you know, in family businesses, I see it where the dad is now 75 or 80 and hasn't let go of the reins yet. And his son, who he's been grooming to be his successor, is retirement age, and he hadn't had a chance to have any run at the thing yet. And he's frustrated, and he realizes that his best years are probably behind him, but he doesn't know what else to do. And so that's an important thing for me to think through a little bit, about how do you train people to start handing off the baton at the get-go. That's a good thing for me to think about, David. I need to think that through.
Well, you might be doing it instinctively too. And let me ask you, so you help with succession planning. I would assume you're also helping with exit strategies as a version of that. So maybe it's not going to a family member, but maybe it's an exit strategy either to an ESOP, you know, employee buyout, or maybe it's selling to another company or whatever it might be. What are the key differences you see between the two?
Well, a succession plan has to do with passing the company on. An exit strategy has to do with the leader who is leaving. For me, the biggest hindrance to a successful exit strategy is only leaving from something, not leaving to something else. And so the leader hasn't, what's going to be the next stage of my life? I mean, if all your life is only about leading this company, you're a pretty shallow person. And if you can't leave to something else, you're going to be unhappy, because you're going to have a vacuum, and nature abhors a vacuum. You know, something will rush in to fill it, and it's usually not stuff that we really like. So I think that it's so important for for leaders to have some kind of a life plan in place that says, okay, this is, you know, I'm more than just my company. I have a meaning that goes beyond that. And then, so I've got one CEO right now that I'm working with in Convene who is at the end of 2017 is going to step down from being the CEO of his company. He's still vital, but he's got, you know, helps rescue girls from sex trafficking. And so, he's going to devote some time to help him rescue more girls. He helps create jobs for girls that are rescued from sex trafficking. And so he's going to do that. He's got a 12-year-old son or 13-year-old son that is just entering into that pivotal teenager set. So he's going to spend more time with the son. So he's leaving from the business to something else. And, yeah. And so he can do it with excitement. He's not, you know, and that's what makes a successful exit plan is leaving with excitement, because then you're not always going back and saying, oh, can I just pull one more string? Because you're leaving for something rather than just from something.
Yeah. No, I think it makes perfect sense. And I think that's key. A lot of it comes, I'm working with a group now who want me to help some people develop one-page business plans, one-page life plans, and one-page exit strategies. So those three work together. They're integrated so people can, you know, achieve more. But when it's time to move on, that they've had the balance in their life versus focusing too much on the work and it becomes too much about them, or they haven't, you know, or maybe they've just been busy at work versus really achieving growth and achieving what they could achieve. So
I'm just reading a book right now. We had a speaker out, Chuck Blakeman, not too long ago, wrote a book, Making Money is Killing Your Business. And he talks a lot about the why. You know, Simon Sinek also talks about, you know, first ask why. Yeah. The why of our lives is huge for us for an exit plan. So I would encourage everybody to think very seriously about what is your why?
Yeah, no, I think that makes sense. So I know you need to jump to a meeting because we're getting you in your car right now. So you squeeze this in, which I appreciate that. I want to have you back. I definitely want to have you back. There's a lot more. Of course, you know, I always like talking to you.
We'll do it sometime over a cup of coffee live, maybe. How's that sound?
Yeah, that sounds good. Or maybe, you know, you can take me to Yosemite and walk me around. I'm envious of the time you've spent in Yosemite. We can do it in some remote location that has Wi-Fi or something.
There you go. There you go.
Any, you know, closing comments?
Well, that Yosemite Wi-Fi thing, we took a trip. We were probably 30 miles from civilization, and yet guys could call home at night. So figuring out how to get away from the demands of business, even when you're in the middle of a backpack trip, is becoming more and more of a challenge, and yet we need that time away. I don't know, I could leave you with that since you brought up the backpacking thing. So
yeah, I think that's a great place to leave off. So I want to thank you for being with us. I want to thank everybody for joining us, and I'm looking forward to having you back, Marcus. You take care. I look forward to seeing you in person sometime soon, I hope.
Yeah, come on down. Wait till the floods stop, though.
Yeah, okay. Well, at least is Folsom Lake full now?
No, they're purposely keeping it down, but they're letting so much water out of it that the American River's all flooded because we've got 25 feet of snow in the Sierras that are all going to melt pretty soon, and we'll have to be doing it all over again. So, yeah, Don Pedro and Oroville have both let stuff out of their spillways. We're having floods all over the place down here.
Wow. So. All right. Well, thanks so much for being with us. I look forward to next time. You take care.
All righty. Take care.
Thanks, everyone, for listening. I really enjoyed talking with Marcus. As you heard, I want him to come back again. He's got a lot of information in his head, experiences that can help you. If you enjoyed the podcast, please consider subscribing. Love to have you as a subscriber, either on iTunes or YouTube. That'd be great. We're posting new episodes every week. Next week, we have Steve Meek with us, who is co-founder and president of the Fulcrum Group in Texas.
They are a managed service provider. Steve has been on advisory boards with Ingram Micro, done a lot of interesting things, worked with a lot of leaders, and he really takes leadership and company culture to heart. I'm sure you're going to find some insights that he has applicable in your organization. So hope you come back. See you then. Bye-bye.